So this is not the video I'd originally planned to bring you this week. That video will now be coming your way at a later date. What I'm going to try to do today instead is to persuade you to sign a letter, or at least digitally sign a letter anyway. And the reason I'm going to try to persuade you to sign a letter is because a few days ago, on Thursday the 27th of November, I spent the morning sitting in the magnificent Central Hall in Westminster, London, alongside an audience of more than 1,200 people, including more than 150 parliamentarians and leaders from business, culture and the media. The event was called the National Emergency Briefing, and it pulled absolutely no punches in its explanation of the climate emergency we now find ourselves in, both as a nation and as a global civilization. And if just the mention of that phrase has you reaching for your keyboard or mouse to select a different video, then I would say that is precisely the reason why you should stick with me and keep watching this one. If we lived in a rational world, the presentations given last Thursday would have been priority live streamed on every network news channel, and the event would have made that day's headlines. In reality, it wasn't broadcast by any of the big four UK TV channels, and it didn't make the evening news. And that's where you come in. Allow me to explain. Hello, and welcome to Just Ever Think. So I'll come to the letter a bit later in the video, but before we get to that, I guess I should give you a bit of a clue as to exactly what this national emergency briefing was all about, shouldn't I? Well, essentially, 10 of the UK's leading experts in all these critical disciplines and activities each presented their own 10-minute or so briefing to MPs, peers of the realm, and the rest of us audience members, explaining the impacts that our rapidly changing climate is already having in their particular sectors, and outlining the risks and hazards that are looming frighteningly large if we humans continue down the path we're currently on. The information and messages we all received in those presentations were at times very scary, at times just plain depressing, and once or twice actually surprisingly uplifting. But most important of all, it was absolutely essential that they were heard, especially by the policymakers who made the effort to attend. The event was chaired by Professor Mike Berners-Lee, who many of you will know from his research work on climate footprints and from his best-selling book called There Is No Planet B, which I've made a couple of videos about on this channel in the past. If you're a UK TV viewer, you will also undoubtedly be familiar with Chris Packham, both as a well-loved presenter of nature programmes on the Beeb and as a tireless campaigner on animal rights and climate issues. He calls a spade, does our Chris, and this snippet from his opening statement was characteristically blunt.
For those of you at the back, that looks like a pale blue dot. But that's us. That's our home. That's our one and only home. It's the only one we've got. It's where all of our species has lived and died. Everyone. Every single human. It's where we breathe, it's where we eat, we laugh, we cry, we love, we hate. And as far as we know, together with all the other wonderful life on Earth, we are the only known life forms in the universe. And we've got nowhere else to go. It's not thousands, it's not hundreds of thousands or millions of lives that are at risk. It's billions of lives that are at risk. We are one species on one planet.
So, you know, that sort of set the scene. But you have to quantify the rhetoric with data, don't you? That's exactly what this channel is all about. And it's precisely what we got from Professor Kevin Anderson, who's also not a man known for mincing his words.
If we measure the concentration of carbon dioxide in parts per million, and we look at that across the last, say, 800,000 years, and compare that with today, we see a plot that looks like this. Now, that has a variation in that of about 100 parts per million going up and down, basically related to the ice ages. If we then focus in on the last 10,000 years, and that's the time when human societies have really flourished, what we see then is a pathway that is much more stable in carbon dioxide. The variation has only been about 20 parts per million in that period of time. And so we've had a very stable temperature and a very stable climate during the flourishing of our societies. If we then look at the end of this, and so this is really where we began to burn fossil fuels, in about 1850-ish, and we were about 280 parts per million by volume at that particular time. And if we look at that where we are today, we're now at 424 parts per million. Almost overnight, we've gone to these ridiculously high levels, and it's rising rapidly every single year. The way the science is going at the moment, we're going to see a rise of about 2 degrees centigrade or so by the middle of this century. That's very hard to imagine that we'd be any less than that. But there's now a small but very real risk that we could hit 4 degrees centigrade by the end of this century. Now, the prospects of 3 and 4 degrees centigrade of warming are absolutely dire. I mean, we cannot risk that at all. It is an extreme and unstable climate, far beyond any safe zone that has nurtured our civilization. And we're going to be seeing unprecedented societal and ecological collapse at these sorts of levels. We can see escalating geopolitical instability and rising military tensions. And there will be no real economy to talk about. There's no reduction in GDP. We'll be looking at systemic collapse.
But of course, we're already seeing some of those effects right now, aren't we? Here's Hayley Fowler, Professor of Climate Change Impact at Newcastle University.
By 2050, one in four properties, 8 million in England, will be at risk of flooding. A new research by my group shows that UK winter rainfall has increased by 10% since 1980 because of the fossil fuels we're putting into the atmosphere. Now, an extra 30 millimetres of rainfall each winter sounds really small, but across the UK, that's 7.3 billion cubic metres of extra water. It's the same as 3 million Olympic-sized swimming pools, with an effect on flooding. This trend is some 25 years ahead of global climate model predictions. The extreme heat of 19th of July 2022, you'll remember that. Across the UK, records were shattered. Temperatures over 40 degrees were recorded for the first time. It caused around 3,000 excess deaths. In fact, heat waves in Europe are intensifying faster than anywhere in the world and much faster than climate models predict. UK fire services no longer have the resources to keep the public safe in extreme heat, and as heat waves get longer and hotter, fires will become more common. The Climate Change Committee's latest assessment is very clear. The UK is not adapting fast enough to a rapidly changing climate. The committee highlights three major gaps: weak governance, unclear responsibilities, and insufficient funding. It's sobering when you realise that this is the least extreme climate you will experience in your lifetime. Until we stop burning fossil fuels, extreme weather will continue to get worse.
Not really the sort of world we want to leave for our kids and grandkids, is it? If you're a regular viewer, you'll have heard me talking about the tipping points in Earth systems that are rapidly coming our way as a consequence of those rising temperatures, and which can suddenly turbocharge the climate into an even more hazardous state. The dangers of those tipping points were recently set out in graphic detail in this report, co-authored by Tim Lenton, who's Professor of Climate Change and Earth System Science at the University of Exeter. And Professor Lenton was at the National Emergency Briefing to give us a quick summary.
If you're wondering what a tipping point is, you could just lean back on your chair to that balance point where you know that a small change is going to make a big difference to your state or your fate. There'll be a self-propelling change from one stable state of the system to another.
But it was Tim's explanation of the consequences of a collapsing AMOC that really gave pause for thought, especially for those of us living here in Western Europe.
In London, it's minus 20 degrees C and 3 frozen months of the year. And in Edinburgh, it's minus 30 degrees C and 5.5 frozen months of the year. And yet the summers will still be hotter than today because it's a 2 degrees warmer world, not a 1.4 degrees warmer world. And the simple version is it eliminates the possibility to grow crops in the UK. But that's possibly the least of our worries, because there'd be a major water security crisis. We calculate that there'd be not enough water from the winters to get through the summers in the southeast of England, where most of the people are, like us today. And then in the global context, this is a simple calculation of what passing this tipping point does for the viable areas for growing two major staple crops, wheat and maize, worldwide. And they're reduced by more than a half. So it's a global food security crisis.
And that brings us neatly to the difficult conversation that absolutely nobody I know ever seems to want to have. And that's how we continue to feed ourselves as a society in the context of our rapidly changing climate. Here's Paul Berens, Professor in Environmental Change at the University of Oxford, to give us a bit of a clue.
For generations, a stable climate has given us reliable harvests. But that era, as we've heard, is gone. One study in a top journal found that before climate change, a major corn harvest failure might happen once every 16 years. At 1.5 degrees of warming, that rises to once every 3 years. At 2 degrees, it's once every other year. The good news is that the research is crystal clear on what we need to do. And, fortunately, it's healthier for us. We need a great food transformation built on 4 main pillars. Shifting to plant-rich diets, reducing food waste, improving production, and increasing climate resilience. Research from our team and many others across the UK show that healthy, sustainable diets can still include some meat and dairy, just far less of it. Now, I know this can be politically difficult to talk about, but we have to be straight with people about the choices ahead, because if we don't lead this change on the front foot, we'll be forced into this change anyway as food shocks intensify and as animals are hit harder by climate change than the crops. And if we can... And if we can be on the front foot, this is where the story becomes one of extraordinary opportunity. I talked before about threats to food supply, but this is how we can create climate resilience. We can use some of that spared land to grow more of the food we need here in the UK. It will cut over-reliance on imports, and you can feed many more people per hectare on a plant-rich diet.
It's not just food, though, is it? Climate impacts are affecting every aspect of our economy and pretty much all major economies across the planet. Angela Francis is Director of Policy Solutions at the UK arm of the Worldwide Fund for Nature.
In every transition, every industrial and agricultural revolution, new technologies replace the old, societies change, you get innovation and productivity leaps, and there are winners and losers, and the losers lobby the government. The investment the UK needs to make to stay on the CCC's balanced pathway is equivalent to about £4 billion a year. That's 0.2% of GDP. The majority of that investment would be paid by the private sector. With the right incentives and policy, they would cover 40 to 90% of what is needed. And the public sector share could be funded by national banks and asset-backed lending, where the economics stack up like they do here. Globally, wind is being built out 3 times the pace we thought it would be in 2015. Solar installations are 15 times faster than we thought they would be. EVs, we're expected to have 20% of the market in 2030, have hit that last year, and they're now expected to double market share by 2030. And because faster is cheaper, the cost of the whole UK transition is now 73% cheaper than we thought it would be just 5 years ago. Inflation would have been 7% lower if we had decarbonised the power sector ahead of Russia invading Ukraine. It would have been a further 9% lower if our food system wasn't linked to fossil fuels through fertiliser prices, which went up 400% at that same time. And it would have been 11% lower if we'd have switched to heat pumps earlier.
So there are clearly policies that our elected representatives can enact that could start to drag us out of our current predicament. We just need to convince those representatives to do the right thing, which is why I need you to keep watching to the end of the video. But of course, economic prosperity is entirely reliant on a healthy natural ecosystem, isn't it? And as Professor Natalie Seddon pointed out, even without collapsing AMOCs and unsustainable farming practices, there's still quite a lot to be concerned about here too.
We are facing a national emergency, not only because the climate is changing, but because the living systems that regulate that climate, protect our homes and feed our people, are breaking down here in one of the most nature-depleted nations on Earth. You know, recent analyses by the Green Finance Institute and others suggest that if we continue to degrade nature, nature-related risks could severely cut UK GDP in the coming decade, delivering a macroeconomic shock on the scale of major financial crises. So, this is not an issue on the margins of policy. This is a national security issue. Without a living, healthy biosphere, there is no stable economy, no food, no water security, and no public health resilience. Luckily, we know what works, and the science points to the following. First of all, we need to consider nature as critical infrastructure. Second, we need to stop funding harm, and we need to reward restoration. Third, we need to redirect finance and measure what actually matters to us. You know, the financial system is sleepwalking into risk, escalating risk. This isn't about choosing between the economy and the environment. It's about recognising that the economy is embedded within the environment and that the health of the nation depends on the living systems that sustain us and that we are part of.
Then there's the impacts of a warming world on human health, not just in the dangerously hot and in some cases already borderline uninhabitable regions around the equator, but increasingly in almost every society on Earth, including here in Europe, as Professor Hugh Montgomery laid out in no uncertain terms. I've left a link in the description to his full presentation, as I have for all the other presentations at the briefing, but here's just a quick taster of how Professor Montgomery, who is a time-served, battle-hardened NHS consultant, is feeling about the adverse consequences on people's health that he's already witnessing.
I work in climate change, but I'm an NHS lifer. I'm a barefoot doctor working in a North London intensive care unit. And my day job is emergencies. Whether it's global pandemics or 7/7 events such as this, terrorist attacks, or the more mundane, the people who come in acutely unwell on any one of the days of the week. I know what an emergency looks like, and I know how you respond to an emergency. And you don't respond to emergencies with talk and homeopathy. You respond with genuine action. We've had an honest conversation. I am scared. I'm 63. I may not have that much longer left on the planet, but I'm scared for my own life and future, and I'm absolutely terrified for that of my son, and you should be too. Is this an emergency? It is an emergency. Now it is an emergency, and it requires treatment. This is no longer a risk. Without action, these impacts are certainties. And the hazards are catastrophic. If we take action, we might survive to leave the hospital. If we do not, the outcome is absolutely certain. So I leave you with this thought. The climate emergency is a health emergency, and it's about time we started treating this one.
And if that's not scary enough for you, how about national security risks? Well, never fear, because the National Emergency Briefing had us covered on that one too. Here's Lieutenant General Richard Noogi with a couple of sobering thoughts.
I spent over 35 years in the Army serving in, among other places, Northern Ireland, Iraq and Afghanistan. Even 5 to 10 years ago, if you'd raised climate change in the MOD, most people would nod politely, move on, with even a couple of top officials telling me, we're exempt climate change. But that has now changed. The MOD is now looking at environmental impacts with a team working on climate security, energy self-sufficiency for our forces, and how they can adapt to a rapidly changing planet. Why? Because the threat picture is shifting faster than we expected and faster than we anticipated. Climate shocks fuel global instability. When farmers can no longer earn a living, they're recruited by non-state actors. And we saw this in Afghanistan, and we saw this with ISIS in Iraq. The Arctic is becoming a new flashpoint due to the climate crisis directly. You've heard how sea ice is receding and at 4 times the rate of the rest of the world. But let's put that into a geopolitical perspective. The Russian Duma has claimed it's a Russian internal sea, whereas we treat the Arctic as international waters. So there's risk of conflict over access, over resources, and, of course, over shipping routes. So the climate crisis is now shaping strategic and military competition. The encouraging part is that what we need to do on climate also makes Britain safer and more resilient. Take energy independence. Renewables, storage and a decentralised grid reduce our dependence on foreign oil and gas, and they're less vulnerable.
That last comment was very much endorsed by the final speaker at the event, Tessa Khan, who's an international lawyer and founder of a climate campaign organisation called Uplift. Let's get a couple of thoughts from Tessa, and then we'll talk about that letter I want you to sign.
An energy system based on renewables offers countless obvious economic advantages over one that runs on fossil fuels. Most obviously, the input, sun or wind, is free forever. Whereas if you buy a barrel of oil, as soon as you burn that, you need to buy another one. And the price that you pay for it is determined by a cartel of petrostates or subject to the whim of dictators. Further, the price of key technologies for a renewables-based power system has steeply declined in recent years, with the cost of electricity from offshore wind dropping more than 50% in the last decade, more than 70% in the case of solar, and the price of battery storage dropping more than 80% in that same period. Just as importantly, renewables are also vastly more efficient than fossil fuels. A typical petrol car only uses about 25% of the energy in its fuel to actually move its wheels. Most is lost as heat, and the fossil fuel system as a whole wastes about 2/3 of the raw energy that goes into it. So unsurprisingly, it's better not to dig up and burn million-year-old fossilised remains of plants and animals when renewable energy, which doesn't involve combustion and therefore constant heat loss, is so much more efficient.
See, I told you there were some uplifting bits, didn't I? So what about that letter then? Well, I guess you should know what it says before you go clicking on any links at the top of the screen or scanning the QR code down here or following the link I've left in the description section, all of which take you to the website where you can sign it. So here it is, read beautifully by the actor Olivia Williams.
To Sir Keir Starmer, to Tim Davey at the BBC, to Carolyn McCall at ITV, to Jonathan Allen at Channel 4, to Sarah Rose at Channel 5, to Geraint Evans at S4C, and Dame Melanie Dawes at Ofcom. Today, hundreds of MPs, peers and leaders from business, faith, sport and culture gathered in Westminster for a national emergency briefing. We were presented with the latest evidence showing that the United Kingdom must urgently prepare for a cascade of serious societal impacts. The rapidly escalating climate and nature crises are set to make the UK increasingly unrecognisable and dangerous. With extreme weather events, the risk of food shortages, price shocks, economic instability and rising geopolitical threat. We are deeply alarmed by the scale of fossil fuel-funded disinformation that has flooded Westminster and the media. The lack of public access to accurate, science-based information has created a vacuum which has been filled by polarised headlines designed to deny and delay action. Under the Communications Act of 2003, all public service broadcasters must inform the public on major national and international issues. That is the law. The UK broadcasters have so far failed to meet these obligations, despite despite the Climate Change Committee urging the government to provide trusted public information. We therefore ask the government and all public service broadcasters to hold an urgent, televised, national emergency briefing. We asked them to run a comprehensive public engagement campaign so that everyone understands the profound risks this crisis poses to themselves and to their family. If delivered urgently and truthfully, with ambition matching the scale of the crisis, this will not only ensure that the public is properly informed, but will also offer the protection that knowledge and preparedness bring. Not just the protection, but the opportunities that preparedness brings. Such a campaign will resonate with the public, opening up the political space for action, not debate. We are not safe. This is an emergency. Now is the time for courage and to put trust in the public. The UK has a track record of uniting to face difficult challenges. Now is the time to do this again. Thank you.
If you're in the UK and you've got this far in the video, then I'm very much hoping you'll be clicking on one of these links right now. And if you're outside the UK, give them a click anyway. And if you do manage to get to the site, then why not sign the letter as well? After all, it's probably just as relevant in your country as it is here. Links to the full presentations are also down there in the description section, as I mentioned earlier. But we're already more than 25 minutes in, so I won't keep you any longer. As always, thanks for watching. And remember to just have a think. See you next week.